So tonight I want to give a talk that I call How One Discovers Truth. And this is actually based on something called the Kamki Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. And the sutta takes the form that is often found in this particular section of the Majjhima Nikaya. And that's where a Brahmin or several Brahmins come and have a discussion with the Buddha. And the sutta starts with this group of Brahmins going to see the Buddha, who is in the neighborhood, right? And Kanki, who's a high-class upper Brahmin, sees them going by and says, "Where are they going?" They tell him, and he asks them to wait because he wants to go see the Buddha too. And the other Brahmins say the Kanki shouldn't go to the Buddha. The Buddha should come to him. Like, Kanki is so important. The Buddha, the Buddha is just this, wanderer. And Kanki is this rich, powerful Brahmin. Kanki corrects them, explaining that the Buddha was once like him. So the Buddha was a prince, he was very wealthy, and he renounced everything to become one accomplished and fully enlightened. So Kanki should go to him. So the Buddha comes, this group of Brahmins come, and they have what called some amiable talk with some very senior Brahmins. Then there's this young upstart Brahmin, Kapatika, begins a long discussion with the Buddha on what is true. He starts by saying that Brahmins, based on their faith in their tradition, have come to the conclusion only this is true, anything else is wrong. Now, where have we heard this before, right? And he says it quite emphatically, like he's just like, gonna one up the Buddha, this young guy, this cocky young guy. And the Buddha sort of comes back to him with several questions. And he says, "Is there any Brahmin who says thus, 'I know this, I see this, only this is true'?" And Kapatika answers, "Well, no." Then Buddha goes on, "Is there any teacher or teachers going back 7 generations who say, 'I know this, I see this, only this is true'?" And once again, Kapatika answers, "Well, no." Then the Buddha goes, "Did any ancient teachers, the composers of the Vedas, say, 'I know this, I see this, only this is true'?" And once again, Kapatika has to go, "Well, no, not really." So the Buddha he's basically asking, are there any Brahmins who are enlightened beings? And Kapatika has to answer honestly, no. And then the Buddha uses this wonderful metaphor. So it seems that among the Brahmins, there is not even a single Brahmin who says thus, "I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong." And among the Brahmins, not even a single teacher or a single teacher's teacher, back to the 7th generation of teachers, who says thus. And the ancient Brahmin seers, the creators of the hymns, the composers of the hymns, even these ancient Brahmin seers did not say thus. Then here's the metaphor. Suppose there were a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. So too, Brahmins, in regard to their statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. What do you think? That being so, does not faith of the Brahmins turn out to be groundless? And then the Brahmins honor this not only out of faith, also it's out of oral tradition. And the Buddha replies, there are five things that may turn out in two different ways here and now. What five? Faith, approval, oral tradition, reasoned cogitation, and reflective acceptance of a view. So this is now the Buddha is saying, yeah, well, your oral tradition, isn't really that solid either. The Buddha says that that's not enough. That these things are all based on what we like to hear or what we've always heard, tradition being that way. It's like, well, it's always been that way, so it must be true. That sort of energy is very common in a lot of different traditions, and certainly in the Brahmic tradition of that time. And then the Buddha says that that's not enough, that what is needed is five things: faith, approval, you think it's okay, oral tradition, reasoned cogitation, reflective acceptance. But the Buddha goes on to say that each of these five can lead to the preservation of truth, i.e., can keep truth alive, but they can also be based on false understanding and can lead one away from the truth. These are all just, they can be wonderful. I love reading parts of the Bible and so on, or things from the Sutta all the time. But they can also lead you astray. It can go either way. And they can be based on false understanding and can lead one from the truth. In other words, instead of heading towards the truth, believing something because of any of these five, the faith, your faith itself, your faith in the Vedas and the case of the Brahmins are true. You think they're okay, and the tradition, the oral tradition, because most traditions at this point weren't written down. There was very little other than the Vedas that were written down. Reasoned cogitation is, well, I think about it and it sort of makes sense. Or reflective acceptance, like, well, I thought about it and yeah, it's got, these are all things that we can, if we're not careful, our own views and opinions, our own ideas of how things should be, are embedded in our understanding. And we don't see that. We only see this is how it's always been, or this is how it makes sense to me. And we don't see how the views and opinions that we cling to can cause us to not see clearly. And of course, the Buddhist tradition is all about seeing things clearly, right? So the Buddha just says, no, sorry, that list of five things just isn't good enough. Oh, says the Brahmins, oh, what do we do now? So then it goes on. In that way, Master Gotama, there's the preservation of the truth. In that way, unpreserved truth. In that way, we recognize the preservation of truth. But in what way, Master Gotama, is there the discovery of truth? In what way does one discover truth? We ask Master Gotama about the discovery of truth. So finally, the Brahmins have sort of run out of arguments. They've sort of given all their traditional arguments. And the Buddha, and then they go to the Buddha and say, well, what else could there be? And the Buddha gives it quite a long answer. And the Buddha starts his response to this question by saying that first you must look at the teacher and see if they are unaffected by the three poisons: greed, hatred, and delusion. If the teacher doesn't see clearly yet, how can the teachings be true? It's an interesting question, huh? I mean, and I don't claim to be free of greed, hatred, and delusion, let me tell you. So all I can do is do my best. But what the Buddha is pointing to here is that we need to actually question the source of the teachings. Where are these teachings coming from? Who is the person who is actually doing this teaching? Are they basically pure enough? Are they okay to actually be doing this teaching? Should I actually be listening to these people at all? And then the Buddha goes on after, haranguing them about this for a while. Says, and so if you get to the point where, yeah, you believe this teacher is appropriate, then the Buddha says, when he has investigated him and has seen that he is purified from states of delusion, that he places faith in him, filled with faith, he visits him. So this is what we now see. Now that we've actually seen the teacher is not deluded, then here's what we need to do. Here's how we actually can go towards the truth. When he has investigated him and has seen that he is purified from states based on delusion, then he places faith in him. Having filled with faith, he visits him and pays respects to him. Having paid respect to him, he gives ear. And when he gives ear, he hears the Dhamma. Having heard the Dhamma, he memorizes it and examines the meaning of the teachings he has memorized. When he examines their teachings, he gains a reflective acceptance of those teachings. When he has gained a reflective acceptance of the teachings, zeal springs up. So those first five are just the five that the Brahmins listed. But the Buddha said, yeah, that's a good list, but you better make sure who they're coming from. And then he lists five more. When he gains reflective acceptance of these teachings, zeal springs up. When zeal has sprung up, he applies his will. Having applied his will, he scrutinizes. Having scrutinized, he strives. Resolutely striving, he realizes with the body the supreme truth and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. In this way, Brahmins, there is the discovery of truth. In this way, one discovers truth. In this way, we describe the discovery of truth. But as yet, there is no final arrival at the truth. So he said, even with these 10 things, which I'm now going to go through, even with these 10 things, you haven't got there yet. There's still more to do. But let's look at these 10 things here. Starts with faith. And this is faith in the teacher. This is like not having doubt, having got past the place where you doubt the teacher. Yet this teacher, I can see this teacher that is teaching from a pure place, and so I have faith in this teacher, and I will then pay attention to this teacher. And then you visit the teacher. You actually go to the teacher and you pay respect. These days, of course, visiting might be online. That's okay. But it's like you actually go and hang out with the teacher. Go pay respects. So it's like a lot of the suttas, when people come to see the Buddha, they come to see the Buddha, they bow and they walk in a certain way and sit in a certain way. Now they're ready to actually hear the teaching. Then, once you've visited and paid respect, you actually listen to the teachings. Actually pay attention. It isn't like I'm going to go hang out and because it's a cool place and all these cool people are going to be there. You actually really pay careful attention to what's actually being said by the teacher. And that means you're hearing the Dhamma. You're actually taking in the teachings of the Buddha or the teacher. And then you memorize the teachings. This is a very ancient tradition. First of all, a lot of the teachings in the Buddhist time were all, and certainly all of the Buddhist teachings were strictly oral tradition. Nothing was written down till at least a couple of hundred years after the Buddha left. And so memorizing the teachings was a way to preserve them. If we're talking about preserving truth, this is a way by memorizing the teaching. So in the Sangha of monks and nuns who followed the Buddha, everyone had a job to memorize a certain section of the sutta so that they could repeat it and teach it to others. But the interesting thing is, until you could memorize the teachings, or a particular teaching, you weren't ready to understand it, according to the tradition. You memorized it, you knew it backwards and forwards, in a sense, the wording of it, and then the teacher would explain it to you in more detail, and you could then accurately be able to reflect on its meaning. Because you knew the, it wasn't like, well, sometimes you hear a teaching and it's like one sentence and it goes, oh yeah, that makes sense. But you don't hear the whole thing, you don't hear it in context. So you have to memorize the entire teaching. I'm telling you, you have to do this, but it's an interesting idea. And then once you've memorized it, now you're ready to really dig into it and understand it. And you can examine the meaning. And then you have reflective acceptance. This does actually, when I reflect upon the meaning, it makes sense. And this, at this point, the 5 points mentioned earlier have all been covered. This is what the Brahmins said they did to their teachings. And then the Buddha said, yes, but here's 5 more things you need to really preserve the teachings and understand them. Zeal. Love that word. It's an old-fashioned word, but it's like it implies a certain, wow, isn't this amazing sort of vibe. It's like you not only are you do you know the teachings and you've reflected upon them, but they uplift you somehow. This is sometimes they hear in a lot of the lists, and you'll see something called piti, which sometimes gets translated as rapture, but it's more like excited energy about the teeth, whatever it is. It's like, wow, this is so amazing. It's all sort of the vibe, right? And then, once you have zeal, once you're excited, then comes will. It's like a fixed determination. This is where wholesome effort. The sixth step on the Eightfold Path comes in here. It's like, okay, not only do I understand it, not only do I am I excited by it, but now I'm going to really put some effort into it, into actually practicing it to a certain extent. And then the next one is scrutinizes. I had to look at the commentaries on what scrutinizes mean in this context. I mean, scrutinize usually means like looking closely, but actually it means in this context, it means you gain insight. So insights into the teaching starts to arise. So this is beyond, now you've gone beyond the reflective understanding, figuring things out into some sort of deeper intuitive understanding. And then striving, which takes those insights deeper. So it's like, not only I see it, I have this moment of insight, and then I keep working with it and going, the insights become deeper and broader and sort of stick with me more. And then comes number 10 on this list. Penetrating wisdom, which once again I had to read the commentaries. This means what's called stream entry. Stream entry in the Theravada tradition means At most, there'll be another five lives. Oh, only five more. before the being connected to this bundle of karmic energy that's being part of the stream enterer at the moment, that bundle of karmic energy becomes an enlightened being in only five more incarnations. Big deal, in other words. This is like, or once again, so I've been told. Stream entry occurs, and then you have this ongoing energetic impetus, from what I understand, that keeps you going because you've entered the stream. In other words, you're flowing with the teaching. You've stopped fighting, stopped going against, you stopped doubting that the kalesas have really weakened. They don't have much power anymore. They're flowing with the stream. But then the Buddha says, "Oh yeah, but wait a second. There's still more. So you're a stream enterer. Well, that's okay. It's nice, but in that way, Master Gotama, there is discovery of truth." In that way, one discovers truth. In that way, we recognize the discovery of truth. But in what way, Master Gotama, is there the final arrival at truth? In other words, we have an inkling of it, we have some understanding of it, we have a feeling for it. But how do I get to the point where I really know? Where the final arrival of the truth, Brahmins, lies in the repetition, development and cultivation of those same things. In other words, practice, practice, practice. That's all. It's like here we have this list of 10 things, and now we practice them. In the repetition, development, and cultivation of those same things. In this way, there is final arrival at truth. In this way, one finally arrives at truth. In this way, we describe the final arrival at truth. So, even when you're deep into the practice, when you become a stream enterer, now you're encouraged to practice even more. Keep going, keep going, keep going. You've got an inkling, you've got a sense of it, you've had some insight, but now you need to go deeper still. Got to keep that practice going. You don't stop and go, "Oh well, I figured this stuff out now." It's like, keep going, keep going. And the other thing the Buddha is saying here in this is that you have to do it yourself. The teacher can give you the teachings, you can hear the teachings, but the actual arrival at enlightenment comes through your own efforts. There's no magic formula, there's nothing that anyone can do other than you doing the practice. You have to, as he says, in repetition, development, and cultivation of these same things. Practice, practice, practice. There's a poem that reflects this to a certain extent. I wanted to share. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. It's called Mysteries, yes. Truly, we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. Ever feel like that sometimes? That's too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of lambs. How rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity, while we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or the scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. I love that line. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. The Brahmins of this sutta. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. Sounds like what I would like to think I could practice. I have some more things to say about this. Notice that this list of these 10 things starts with faith. Faith comes first. It's like right understanding, in a sense. It's where everything begins. But faith implies something more. It's like, you know, we talk about taking a leap of faith. And this isn't, I'm not talking about blind faith. I'm not talking about, the Buddha never said, just believe this stuff and you'll be okay. But it's like, when I think of taking refuge in the Buddha, for me, that's an act of faith. I've never known the Buddha. I never will know the Buddha. I'm not enlightened in any way. Maybe little bits, maybe tiny, tiny bits once in a while or something, who knows. But there's this person who existed 2,600 years ago who seemed to actually have achieved something quite marvelous. And he says over and over and over again, the Buddha says the same thing. He says, you too have Buddha nature. You too have this possibility to achieve this. It isn't just me and you, all you other people, just believe what I say. Go and do the practice. But I have to have faith that that's true. And that's the faith part. When I take refuge in the Buddha, I'm taking refuge, I'm taking an act of faith that what the Buddha says is actually achievable. Then we have to hear, study, memorize, think about the Buddha's teachings. This is taking refuge in the Dhamma. You know, the teachings of the Buddha. And there we have, what do we want to do? We want to hear them, we want to study them, we want to memorize them. We want to think about them and reach what he called reflective acceptance. Yeah, not only are these teachings brilliant, they actually sort of make sense to me. They feel right. And I am encouraged by the fact that the Buddha created this vast body of teaching that shows me the direction, at least. Go that way. You know, try this. See what happens. Experience it for yourself. It's not like, just do this or else. There's no or else. It's just practice. Here's what you can practice. This is taking refuge in the Dhamma. What we do every time we gather like this, we're taking refuge in the Dhamma. And then, we do all this all together. You know, we encourage each other. I mean, I'm sitting here in this seat called the teacher's seat. But it encourages me that you're here wanting to hear this and taking it in. It makes me want to keep teaching. And I'm sure it makes you want me to do what I'm doing. That's taking refuge in the Sangha. That's what taking refuge in the Sangha means. We can share this determined path together. That's taking refuge in the Sangha. This is why I chant the three refuges every time I teach, because it sort of reminds me that this is what we're actually doing. We're expressing faith, we're expressing love of the Dhamma and love for each other. And that's what keeps me going and keeps the teachings going. And has kept the teachings going for 2,600 years, which I think is like, it's astounding. You know, this stuff 2,600 years ago, this person existed and taught. And here we are, sitting here in, in our own homes, sharing it. It's really amazing. Quite powerfully amazing, as far as I'm concerned. One more poem. This is just the part of a poem from Mary Oliver again. And it's called To Begin With the Sweet Grass. And this is the last section. What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself. Never mind that I had to, since somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I've come out from my confinements, though with difficulty. Like, isn't that a great phrase? Come out from my confinements. We can find ourselves more often than not. I mean the ones that thought to rule my heart. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They'll be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment somehow or another. And I've become a child of the clouds and of hope. I've become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I've become older, and cherishing what I've learned, I've become younger. And what I risk to tell you this, which is all I know, love yourself, then forget it, then love the world. It's like the essence of the Buddha's teaching in one line. So that's what I have to share this evening.